she's not with Reggie. I'd say Matarife has her. Sergeant Burke looked up from his notebook. Matarife? That would be my guess, Fung said. He was already working on the map, both hands moving with the pen across the yellow legal pad since they were cuffed together. Burke shot a sideways glance at Callahan. Matarife means slaughterer. Callahan rubbed her eyes with the heels of her hands. This whole thing made her bones tired. There was a reason agents timed out of Crimes Against Children task forces. Her supervisor had warned her after her last emotional outburst that she was definitely coming to the end of her shelf life with the CAC. Fung kept at his drawing, hunched over the legal pad. I've never met him, but I hear Matarife is into some pretty nasty stuff. Be more specific, Burke said. Eddie shrugged. I'm actually onto something else for my story, so all this stuff with the girls was just extra. Believe me, once I got what I needed, I was going to make some calls and get the girls out of there.
Must have been really important, Burke said, for you to leave them in slavery while you got your precious story.
You have no idea. Fung hung his head. But I understand how it looks, how it is. I should have called someone.
Yes, you should have, Eddie, Callahan said. But you can make a difference now. Let's get back to what you know about Matarife.
All I heard was whispers. Rumor is he leads some kind of blood cult. But I think that's just a story to scare the shit out of the competition. I haven't put it together yet, but he's somehow linked to a guy they call Coronet. That's who I'm looking to find, Coronet. I suspect he works with a contact in mainland China. Sun Yeon Triad, Tres Equis, Coronet, and the PRC. They're all connected. I just haven't put it all together yet.
Well, shit, Callahan said. This was starting to spin out of her control. If it got too big, then violent crimes or one of the counter-intel squads would muscle her out. So tell me, Eddie, how do we find Matarife?
Fung looked up from his map, which was incredibly detailed, considering that he was drawing it with his hands cuffed. He's supposed to have a big house out in the country.
Callahan pounded the table again. Where is this big house?
Fung shrugged.
Still working on that, he said. I haven't managed to get myself invited out there. Until you arrested me, though. My next stop was a mid-level guy named Naldo Cantu, who owns a string of massage parlors in South Dallas. He's a real piece of work, just brutal to his girls. He keeps them strung out to keep them under control. Burns them with cigars for entertainment.
Fung shook his head, as if to clear away the image. I know he pays a fee to operate in Matarife's area. He'd have to know how to get in touch with the guy in order to pay him. Cantu will have some girls on hand. He always does. Could be this friend of Blanca's is with him. I can tell you where he lives.
You can?
Callahan said, surprised at a glimmer of positive news.
Sure,
Fung said. Callahan patted her hand on the table.
Hurry up then, she said. I'm not done with you yet, but if you know where Naldo Cantu is holding girls, I want to act on it right damn now.
Good, Fung said, because there are probably some other things you need to know. An electronic buzzer sounded at the door, nearly sending Fung out of his skin. There was a heavy metallic click, and Tim Dixon, one of the supervisory agents, entered. He had a tall Starbucks cup in his hand with steam coming off the top, which meant it couldn't be for Fung. Prisoners got lukewarm coffee at best, in case they decided to try to weaponize their drink.
Fung dropped the pen on the table and rattled his cuffs. What's going on? Who is this? Is he one of the guys watching me?
Callahan snapped her fingers to shush him, then looked up at Dixon, afraid of what his presence meant. Interruptions like this usually meant a lawyer had shown up. The news turned out to be even worse. Dixon leaned in to whisper in her ear. There's an agent named Caruso here to see you. Apparently he's out of WFO.
Okay, Callahan shrugged. What does somebody from the Washington field office want with me? He knows you have Fung in custody, Dixon said. Callahan gasped. We just scooped him up 2 hours ago. Dixon gave her a knowing nod. Fancy that. And get this. The old man got a call from the office of the director about 5 minutes before this guy slithered in here, telling us to show one Special Agent Dominic Caruso all possible courtesy. He didn't say it, but I'm thinking he's gotta be counter-intel. You have to admit, Kelsey, this whole case has a CI stink to it. Dixon had surely read Callahan's 302 summarizing the interview with Blanca Limon, and now there was Eddie Fung's reference to the People's Republic of China. All this talk of spies and geopolitical competition brought spooks swarming around like blowflies to putrid meat. Callahan wallowed up out of the prison industry's chair, knocking it over and hoping she smashed it in the process. What the hell, Tim? You know this is all wrong. We're saving kids here, not working on spy shit. All possible courtesy, my ass. Dixon sipped his coffee. He's standing right outside the window. I don't care where he is. Callahan yanked open the door. I will not hand over this investigation to a bunch of Washington counter-intel weenies. She nearly ran headlong into a dark-haired man wearing faded jeans and a face full of stubble over a passive smile. He gave her a wink that made her want to punch him in the nose, then said, I think I can help you with that last part. The contract security officers in the lobby of the fortress-like Dallas field office had checked Caruso's credentials and assumed he was armed. The magnetometer beeped when he walked through, which was not surprising to the guards. He wasn't local, but he was an agent, so everyone assumed he would be armed. They did not, however, know that he wore a wire neck loop and microphone connected to the small radio, hidden under the tail of his loose shirt and tucked inside the waistband of his jeans. The tiny earpieces campus operatives wore were designed to blend in, but he'd removed his to be on the safe side. FBI agents were trained to be highly observant, and wearing an obvious wire into the lion's den was sure to earn him a case of the third degree from the old man, the notoriously territorial and protective special agent in charge of the Dallas office. This left Caruso blind to any communication coming from other campus members, but still able to feed pertinent information to them through the mic just out of sight below his collar. He knew it wasn't quite sensitive enough to pick up everything that was being said around him, so he strategically repeated the important stuff while trying not to sound like too much of an idiot. Seriously, he said, shaking Callahan's hand as they stood in the hall outside the interrogation room. You and I have the same goals here. Callahan took a step back and folded her arms, giving him an up-and-down once-over. She was attractive, in an I'll-kick-your-ass sort of way. Her stylish blouse was unbuttoned one button farther than she probably realized. At first glance, her ponytail gave her a look of innocence, but one look from her green eyes warned that she was anything but. At length, she held out her hand and snapped her fingers. Let's see your creds. They checked them downstairs. Callahan scoffed. She reminded Caruso of his mother, checking his hands for dampness to make sure he'd actually washed them before dinner. Well, I want to check them again. He passed the black leather case to her and shot a glance at Tim Dixon while he waited. Don't look at me for aid and comfort, the supervisor said. She just happened to ask you before I did. Callahan studied the ID card and the badge, obviously disappointed that they weren't fake. How did you find out about Fung so quickly? Her lip curled up in disgust. You must have had him under surveillance. And if that's the case, why in the hell didn't you step in and rescue the kids? Could there possibly be anything more important than that? Caruso took a deep breath. First of all, I can't speak to how I knew. But I can promise you that if I'd seen any children in danger, they would have become my highest priority. I would have gotten them out in a heartbeat. Callahan looked at him for a long moment and then handed him back his credentials. I believe you on that one tiny count, Dominic Caruso. But that doesn't mean I'm all giddy about having you attached to my hip. And anyway, if you are what I believe you to be, I fully expect you to lie to me at least a dozen times a day. She turned back to the interrogation room, pausing with her hand on the door. Her eyes softened a notch. Listen, I know what you're doing is probably super-duper important in the great scheme of the geopolitical chess game. But the work my team is doing here isn't a game in any sense of the word. We estimate that there are more slaves in the world today than at any other time in recorded history, and many of them are just kids, being forced to do unspeakable things, sometimes in a rented box truck at some peach orchard, servicing a line of migrant workers waiting their turn, sometimes on a webcam. Some piece of trash gets arrested for child porn, and their defense attorney boo-hoos to the judge and says, "Oh, Your Honor, my client is just a collector. He would never touch an actual child." Well, I say people who collect baseball cards eventually go to a game. People tell me that, in adults at least, prostitution is a victimless crime. Maybe one case in a million, they might possibly have a point. But you try and have sex 10 or 15 times a day and see how you feel. Johns are rapists. They just pay somebody for the experience. Caruso raised both hands in surrender. I'm not arguing with you. Really, I am on your side. I just wanted you to know why I'm so bitchy right from the get-go, Callahan said. There is so much inertia in this ocean of evil shit that I have to push back or I'll drown, you know? Anyway, I haven't quite figured out Eddie Fung's angle yet. But he's about to tell us where we can find a guy one step up the ladder in what looks like a major human trafficking ring. Supposedly, there's some connection to a Chinese guy that goes by the handle of Coronet. That mean anything to you? Coronet? Caruso said, repeating it so Clark and the others could hear. I'm interested to hear where we can find a link to him. Mind if I come along? Do I have a choice? Caruso grinned. Not really. Chapter 17. John Clark's voice crackled over the radio immediately after Caruso repeated Naldo Cantu's address. We've got about 20 minutes if we're lucky with traffic, Clark said. Everyone jump. I want to see what kind of intel we can grab before they get there. Copy that, Ryan said. The rest of the team confirmed they'd heard the transmission and were immediately en route. Interstate 35 was a stone's throw away from the FBI field office, around which he and the others were strategically parked so as to be close enough to pick up Caruso's transmissions. His signal was garbled but readable. I-35 ran directly from Dallas to Red Oak, roughly 18 miles away, which meant Ryan and the rest of the campus could reach their objective in a relatively short time, as long as the evening traffic didn't snarl. But the same held true for Special Agent Callahan and her task force. It would take a few minutes for the raid team to hit the head and gear up. Judging from the tone of her voice, this lady didn't seem like the kind to mess around. She wouldn't be far behind. You gonna try and get there sometime today or what, Jack? Ding asked from the passenger seat. Ryan accelerated south on the freeway. Traffic was heavy but moving, and going close to the speed limit. Midas spoke next. He was behind the wheel in the car with Clark now, and his impatience at the traffic was evident in his voice. They'll be able to use lights and sirens to get through this shit. Caruso sure as hell better stall. Adara defended her boyfriend. Dom will do what he can, she said. He'll definitely let us know when they're on the road. Ryan sped past a highway patrolman doing 90. Mercifully, the trooper had already pulled over another vehicle. It was dark and beginning to sprinkle by the time Ryan took the exit to Farm Road 644. Midweek traffic was light on the farm-to-market road, even at rush hour, and he poured on the speed, feeling the Avenger's engine open up with a throaty roar. He'd been nearest to the interstate when Dom gave the address, so he felt certain Midas's and Adara's vehicles were somewhere behind him. "Watch these wet roads, Mano," Chavez said as Ryan drifted around a corner, a mile away from their target residence now, according to the GPS on his phone. "Nag, nag, nag," Ryan said, and punched the gas. Chavez flipped him off and hung on to the side handle. A minute later, Ryan slowed, driving past a white frame house set back off the road about 500 feet. Barbed wire fencing, meant to keep in cattle, ran in front of the property, and a heavy gate made of rusted drilling pipe blocked the entry. The porch light was visible through the trees. Ryan took the first left past the target address. He was surprised to find Clark's pickup truck already parked in the tall Johnson grass along the gravel road. He and Midas were nowhere to be seen. "How the hell did you get here first?" Ryan said into his mic. "Superior navigation, kid," Clark said. "Position?" Ryan asked. "You guys are late," Midas said. "We're already moving up to the house." Clark suddenly gasped over the radio, whispering, "Midas, get up here. Everyone else, stand by." John Clark had seen great evil in his life. He was no stranger to misery. He'd experienced unspeakable sadness and unbearable pain in Vietnam, Eastern Europe, and hot spots around the world. But the worst of it, the incident that gutted him, had happened right here in the good old USA. Admiral James Greer had known the whole story, but he'd taken the secrets with him when he passed away. Sandy knew most of it, and she'd probably guessed the rest, though they never talked about it. Clark was able to suppress the memories for the most part. Pam Madden's brutal murder and the vengeance he'd meted out against the pimps and drug dealers who'd done it. He dreamed of her sometimes still, not in a longing way as someone might pine for a lost love, but because he was so incredibly sorry that he'd not been there to save her. He was a former SEAL when they'd met, already entrenched in the ways of warfare and mayhem. But it was Pam's death that pushed him into the instrument that he'd become. Knowing her, watching her turn her life around, and then seeing that life snuffed out, had changed him forever, and left a mark on his soul that could not be erased. His hands shook with pent-up rage when he peered through the window into Naldo Cantu's house, and saw the girls. There were three of them curled into fetal positions and chained by their ankles to filthy mattresses on metal army cots. Two wore short baby doll nightgowns. Another wore nothing but a gray t-shirt and bore obvious track marks. She'd been there a while. All three of the girls had ugly burns on their arms and legs. An overturned garbage can beside one of the cots revealed several used condoms, some syringes, and a wad of candy wrappers. Probably all the girls had had to eat. He could make out two Hispanic men lounging on the couch in the adjacent room watching television and drinking beer. He didn't have a view of the entire room, so there was a possibility of more men inside. Memories of Pamela Madden and the men Clark had killed coursed through his veins. He fought the urge to rush in and shoot these men in the face. He didn't care how many there were. Caruso's voice in his ear startled him. Not an easy thing to do to John Clark. "I'm not very familiar with Dallas. Any guests on our ETA?" Callahan gave a muffled response that Clark couldn't hear. There was the sound of car doors slamming. Then Dom said, "I hear you. Traffic like this, we'll be lucky to get there in 25. Clark nodded at this new information. The girls would be safe soon enough. But he wanted to get his pound of flesh. Prison was too cushy for men like these. Clark backed away from the window and into the live oaks that surrounded the house. Midas met him there. "How do you want to do this?" the former Delta soldier asked. "Drag them out and beat the hell out of them until they talk? Then beat them some more after they talk? You gotta look inside." Midas gave a somber nod. "Through the living room window," he said. "I counted three males, two on the couch, one in a recliner. Two handguns on the coffee table, but no long guns that I saw. I could only see one female through the open door from my vantage point, but she looked in pretty bad shape." "She is," Clark said. "I counted three girls. Not sure about the other rooms." He shook his head to clear it, willing himself to calm down and think. Rage would only blind him. In situations like this, he needed to be calculating and calm. He didn't completely rule out killing an enemy inside the United States, but he'd try to avoid it if possible. These men had crucial intelligence. If he had to wait and let Caruso get it, then... The sound of a screen door slamming pulled him out of his thoughts. There was laughter, and then someone said, "Cerveza!" Gravel crunched. A car door slammed. Midas smiled in the darkness. "Somebody's going on a beer run." Clark spoke in a hoarse whisper, giving orders as he moved back toward the fence. "Jack, move to the east end of the road. Adara, you set up to the west." Clark checked his watch. "Whichever way this guy turns, let him get down the road far enough they can't see him from the house, then box him in. Cautious but quick. Keep in mind, we have about 18 minutes to do what we need to do before we have to exfil." 90 seconds later, Ryan pulled the Dodge in front of a blue Subaru WRX and stepped on the brakes. The driver, a skinny Hispanic male, attempted to go around him, but Ryan put his foot on the gas and nosed the Dodge into the much lighter vehicle, shoving it back into Adara's waiting pickup truck. The skinny kid's eyes flew wide, and he raised his hands as Ryan, Chavez, and Adara bailed out of their vehicles. All of them wore black balaclavas and pointed their pistols at his face. "Damn it," Sherman said as she yanked open the door while Chavez and Ryan covered her. "I was hoping you'd fight." They had him bagged and gagged and trussed in the back of Adara's pickup by the time Midas and Clark rolled up with their lights off. Clark lowered his window and motioned for everyone to follow him back around the corner, just in case Special Agent Callahan and her crew showed up sooner than they thought they would. The skinny kid said his name was Flaco. He started slinging snot and sobbing the moment Clark dragged him out of the truck and ripped the bag off his head. Clark shoved him into the ditch on the side of the road. He knelt there, pleading for his life. The sharp odor of urine filled the night air. It wasn't surprising. If John Clark threw him in a ditch and pointed a gun at him, Ryan was pretty sure he'd lose control of his bladder, too. Clark wore a balaclava as well, but there was enough hatred burning out of his eyes to make his intentions clear. He gave Flaco a brutal kick to the ribs, knocking him over, and then stepped on his neck. "Okay, asshole," Clark said. "You have exactly one chance to stop me from turning your head into bits of skull and goo. Answer my questions as I ask them to you. Don't pause. Don't beg for mercy. Just answer the questions. Do you understand?" Clark bore down with the boot at each word, grinding the man's face into the ground and muffling his reply. "Yes," he said, sounding like a deflating tire. "Who's the top guy? Cantu." It turned out to be harder to get the tattooed gangbanger to shut up than it had been to get his car stopped. "Cantu is boss of the girls around here," Flaco said. "But Zambrano is the top guy in Texas. Everybody who runs girls gotta pay him." "Zambrano," Clark said. "Same name as a Cubs pitcher?"
"Same name," Flaco said. "Different dude. This one's from Mexico."
"Where is he?" Flaco shook his head.
"He's everywhere, man. He moves all the time."
Clark nodded. "How about Matarife?"
"That dude's evil as shit, man," Flaco said.
"Where is he?"
"I don't know."
Clark bore down again.
"Seriously, man," Flaco whined. "I never been to his house. I been places where he does his stuff, though, and it's pretty damn sick."
"Who would know where to find him?"
"On my mother," Flaco said. "I got no idea."
Clark looked at his watch. "There's a Chinese guy been hanging around. What's his name?"
"Eddie."
"Another Chinese guy." Flaco began to hyperventilate.
"Man, since the triad moved in, there's like 100 Chinese guys hanging around. I'm not trying to lie to you, man. I swear it. I'm just not sure who you mean."
"Coronet."
Okay, Flaco said. "I only heard him called that once, but I know who you're talking about now. A sharp dresser. Likes his girls fresh and young. That dude's weird. Acts like he's James Bond or something. But I heard he just sold Christmas cards. His name's Chen. Vinny Chen. Or Vincent, I think. Hey, he would know where Matarife is."
"That doesn't help," Clark said. "Describe Vincent Chen."
Dude, I can do you one better, Flacco said. I got his picture on my phone.
Clark nodded, and Ryan retrieved the cell from Flacco's hip pocket. Fortunately, he'd been face down when he wet his pants, sparing the phone and Ryan's hand.
Password, Ryan said. 1111, Flacco said. Want me to do it? Ryan said, thumb hovering over the touchscreen. He could have a distress signal pre-programmed.
Clark scoffed. Does this look like a guy who plans that far ahead?
Right, Ryan said, and punched in the number. He opened the photos and, after scrolling through some seriously gut-churning pictures of girls, it would be enough to put Flacco away for a very long time. He found a photo of a nattily-dressed Asian man. Rather than leave a virtual trail by sending the image anywhere, Jack used his phone to take a photo of the screen.
How about his phone number? Clark asked.
It's in my contacts, Flacco said. But he was here a day and a half ago. He dumps his phones every few days and gets a new one.
Every few days?
See what I mean? The gangbanger said. Weird shit for a Christmas card salesman.
Where is Chen now? Clark prodded.
No idea,
Flacco said. Who gets the girls for Cantu? Ryan shot a glance at Chavez. This was outside the scope of their mission. They had what they needed on Coronet.
Caruso's voice came across the radio again. Want me to let everyone know we're less than 10 out?
Callahan's muffled voice followed.
They're all behind us, she said. Pretty sure they know already.
Chavez twirled his index finger in the air, reminding everyone that they needed to hurry. Flacco nodded, unaware of the conversation going on in their earpieces.
A guy named Parrot.
Chavez raised both palms to the sky.
Seriously, boss, we need to haul ass.
Clark nodded. Okay. He pressed down on Flacco's neck with his boot one last time before stepping back. Dump his body by the gate.
Wait, 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 Flacco pleaded. You don't have to kill me.
We never had this conversation, Clark said. Flacco's head wagged so hard it looked like it might roll off his skinny neck.
Never, man. I swear it.
Clark hooked a thumb toward the Dodge without another word. Ryan and Chavez dumped the sobbing gangbanger alongside the road, bound hand and foot, and gagged with a piece of tape so he couldn't warn his buds about the approaching parade of vehicles coming down FM 644. Ryan kept his lights off and his foot off the brake until they were well over a mile away. He smiled to himself when he heard Callahan's voice gasp.
Chapter 18. Special Agent Callahan put two Ellis County ambulances on call when she was 2 minutes out from Naldo Cantu's farmhouse. The headlights of her bureau-issued expedition played on the grassy ditch as she came around a slight curve in the road. She nodded toward Caruso.
Jump on the radio and tell Ellis County where we are. I don't want them to—
Oh, shit!
Callahan yanked the wheel hard left, narrowly missing a slender Hispanic man kneeling in the middle of the gravel road, just in front of the gate. His arms were fully sleeved with tattoos, and his hands were taped behind his back. A pillowcase had been pulled over his head. Sergeant Burke and Special Agent John Olson were in the car behind her. Burke had turned his lights off earlier on the approach and narrowly avoided rear-ending the expedition. Callahan reached for the radio in Caruso's hand, snatching it away.
"Listen up," she said. At the same time, she pressed the gas to drive around the hooded man.
Ellis County Sheriff's Office came back. Unit calling?
Damn it, Callahan said. Disregard Ellis County.
She pressed the button on her radio, flipping it back to the encrypted frequency. Leading a task force made up of many different agencies made secure communication problematic. Instead of 10 codes or other unique signal language, she employed plain talk and relied on encryption.
Listen up, she said again when she was back on the secure channel.
The expedition bounced across the rutted field as she drove around the bound man.
Caution as you come to the gate. Hispanic male, tied and hooded. Olson, you and Winston peel off and scoop him up. You're gonna have to stay back and babysit. The rest of you haul ass to the house with me. I'm sure they already hear us coming.
She tossed the mic to Caruso. Now you can call Ellis County with our location.
She wheeled around to the far side of the house, out of the line of fire from the front door. Leave it on the open channel this time, just in case we're walking into a whirlwind of shit. Naldo Cantu and his cousin Reuben were so engrossed in Dancing with the Stars that they had not heard the approaching vehicles. Flacco, who blew a .14 on the PBT, had left the door unlocked when he'd gone for beer, so Jermaine Armstrong didn't even get to use his ram. Now Caruso stood in the yard, just outside the pool of light from the yellow porch bulb. A Rock River Arms LAR-15 with a collapsible stock hung from a single-point sling around his neck. Pistols were well and good, but he always felt better when he had a long gun in situations like this, so he'd borrowed one from the field office. He pressed a cell phone to his ear. John Clark filled him in on the roadside interrogation of Flacco. "Wish I could have been there, boss," Caruso said. He refrained from using names, just in case any member of the task force had better-than-average hearing. Things went off without a hitch here. Two in custody, plus the one bagged at the gate. "The girls?" Clark asked. Caruso took a deep breath. "One of them is in pretty bad shape. Veins were so collapsed from all the dope they've been giving her. Medics had to use an IO gun to get fluid started." Dom winced just thinking about the drill-like device that shot a 15-gauge needle directly into the poor kid's femur. She was so stoned from whatever these assholes had been shooting into her that she didn't feel it. But the heavy thunk of metal puncturing the large bone made Caruso gag. There was a reason he'd gone into law enforcement instead of medicine. "Anyway," Dom continued, "she's on her way to the hospital. Callahan had two Child Protective Services officers follow us out and hang back until we made entry. They're with the other two girls now. Sounds like all three of them are from Mexico. How about you? Did you get anything good?" Clark grunted. "Some. Coronet's last name is possibly Chen. We also got a cell number he's likely to ditch in the next day or two. I've already got Gavin working on it. These guys are the tip of the iceberg with this human trafficking ring. It's worth our time to talk to a few more. They may have more information on Chen and what he's up to."
"Copy that," Caruso said. "You know that thumb drive we heard Fung mention on the GSM bug?
What about it?"
"Some kid, a girl he was sleeping with, swiped it from him, if you can believe that."
"Where's this drive now?" Clark asked.
"The girl gave it to the troopers, who passed it on to the FBI. Special Agent Callahan has it now.
I didn't hear all the interrogation, but somehow Fung got his hands on a bunch of data related to Coronet slash Chen. She believes it has information about human trafficking payouts, etc. I haven't seen it, but the way she talks, it's coded." Clark was silent for a long moment. "Dom," he finally said, "we need to get the information on that thumb drive to Gavin."
"So put in a request," Caruso said. "It's national security related. Jerry can get someone to back-channel the director. He'll order Callahan to turn it over."
"That'll take too long," Clark said. "I need it tonight."
"Are you kidding me?"
This whole conversation made Caruso's stomach ache.
"You want me to steal it from the FBI?"
He could almost hear Clark's smile on the other end of the line.
"Now you're tracking," Clark said.
"The task force isn't even located at the field office. I don't have a code to get in the building."
"Ah," Clark said, "but you've got Gavin."
"Seriously?"
Caruso shook his head and looked skyward. He dropped his voice even lower.
"Hell, forget prison. Callahan will just murder me. Due respect, boss, but—"
Caruso stopped talking and waved at Callahan, who was now marching across the shabby lawn, apparently on the hunt for him.
"She already trusts you," Clark said. "I can hear it in her voice."
Callahan stopped directly in front of him and folded her arms tight across her chest. Her eyes were narrowed, head tilted back so she was looking down her nose. The "explain yourself, Mr. Stance" made him feel like a seventh grader whose mother had just figured out how to search the browser history on his phone.
"Are your friends responsible for that kidnapping?"
"No," Caruso lied. giving her what he hoped was a sufficiently indignant smirk. He chose the more direct no because Callahan would have taken anything else for the dodge that it was. "Why would you ask that?" or "I'm not going to justify your question" were obvious attempts to obfuscate. A quick and direct denial was always best, making sure not to overreact. "Did you sleep with that other woman?" was at one end of the spectrum, while "Did you eat the last of the cereal?" was at the other. "Did your friends kidnap that guy?" fell somewhere in the middle for the appropriate amount of indignation. Still, lying about anything was a slippery game when played with trained interrogators, so he decided it was better to change the subject. "Good job tonight," he said. Callahan nodded. It was obvious that she still didn't believe him, but she unfolded her arms. That was something. "Still no Magdalena, though," she said. "I don't know why, but I thought we might find her here, too." "You saved 3 kids," Caruso said. "That's cause for celebration. Cut yourself a little slack." Callahan said, "Don't get me wrong. I'm happy about that." She sighed, choosing her words carefully. "Hey, I need to talk to Flacco, but the other two have already lawyered up. Want to get a drink after?" "So you can interrogate me, too?" "No," she said, mimicking Caruso's previous indignant smirk. The radio in Callahan's hand broke squelch. "Ellis County fire to any unit at the Cantu residence." The fire department ran the ambulance, 2 of which had just driven away carrying the formerly imprisoned girls. "Special Agent Callahan, go ahead." "Thought you guys might want to know there was a guy parked at the end of the lane when we drove out of there. He pulled the bootlegger's turn when he saw us coming and beat feet." "Did you get a plate number?" Callahan asked. "Sorry," the ambulance driver said. "He made a right before we could catch up to him. We had to turn toward the hospital. I do have a description, though. A small, dark blue pickup. I'm guessing a Chevy S10. Chapter 19. Coronet had no intention of telling Dazid Ishmael that his real name was Vincent Chen. The Abu Sayyaf commander didn't concern himself with such trivialities anyway, and didn't really care so long as he got paid. Both men had chosen unforgiving professions, and they had not survived as long as they had by having lax OPSEC. They'd elected to postpone their talk and parted company shortly after Coronet killed the off-duty PNP officer. Each man had spent the entire night running surveillance detection routes. Chen had no idea exactly what Dazid Ishmael had done. The fact that he was one of the most wanted men in the Philippines and was still alive was testament enough to the man's skill at tradecraft. For Chen's part, he'd utilized a series of taxis and cover locations for his SDRs, spending enough time at each location to allow his team to observe and see if he'd grown any sort of tail. There'd been a scare shortly after midnight when a Davao City police truck parked across the street from the adult cinema Chen had chosen as a cover stop. A short time later, a young woman in short shorts and a halter top arrived in a taxi and got in the police truck. The two sped away into the night. Chen held to the notion that 2 people could keep a secret, so long as one of them was dead. At the same time, there were large portions of his job that required the efforts of more than one man. He needed assistance, but he needed it from people he could trust. Of course, his handlers within the PRC knew this. In the beginning, he'd been part of several teams, learning from some of the best Beijing had to offer on operations from Taiwan to Los Angeles. Eventually, he'd been selected to work on his own and ordered to stop reporting to his regular handler in Beijing. His new handler, a man he knew only as Kevin, was a moderately high-ranking member of either the Chinese military or some facet of the country's murky intelligence apparatus. Chen didn't know exactly which organization or branch, and he didn't care, so long as the missions and the money kept coming his way. In the beginning, Kevin had told him to submit 8 names of operatives with whom he'd worked before to be part of his team. Trust was an often bandied word, but a seldom felt emotion in the intelligence business.
Those who engaged in such work were trained to be untrustworthy, and so expected the same behavior from others. Vincent Chen knew full well at least half the men and women assigned to work with him were sent to spy on him. It was the way the PRC did things. Give someone a job, assign two people to make certain that job was completed under the guidelines of the party, and then assign at least one other to watch the watchers. At some point, all involved knew they were watching and being watched. With the right incentives, in the form of money and actual rather than forced camaraderie, all the internal spying became a laughable house of cards. It took almost 2 years, and the unfortunate deaths of four less loyal members of his team, before Chen felt he'd weeded and pruned his operational cadre into a group of three men and one woman he could trust, or at least on whom he could depend 95% of the time. Each of these four wanted the money he paid them, and each of them had some sort of weakness that he could exploit if the need arose. Gambling debts, an adulterous affair with a ranking party member's wife. In Chen's experience, everyone on Earth had something of a tender white underbelly. Eventually, he'd picked up a handful of other operatives he used around the world who worked on a contract basis. Over the past several years, the sheer size of Chen's payments had led him to realize he'd become an operative for some faction of the PRC government that most of the party knew nothing about. He began earning large bonuses at the completion of each assignment. As team leader, he made sure almost $500,000 a year flowed into the offshore accounts belonging to each of the other members of his cadre. 100,000 of that was distributed by Chen himself from the bonuses he received. A yearly income of $500,000 appeared to be a magic number. Any less, and the danger a competing entity might lure a person away became exponentially greater. Too much more than $500,000, and one began to feel financially independent. It became easier to suck away a little here and there, making the dream of disappearing to some remote corner of the world too much of a reality. Chen's handlers had not seemed to snap to this reality. Expensive cars, fresh young women, constant business class travel, and five-star hotels were all enormously expensive. But the sensitivity of his missions and the sheer genius with which he pulled them off had made him a very rich man. And the rest of his team had been hand-picked because they were much like him. Sure, he had leverage. But more than threat of exposure or even the money, the members of Coronet's team preferred their new lives to their old ones. They were all in their mid-30s, fit and adventurous. Vincent Chen had worked insidiously to make certain that the men and women who worked for him were thoroughly and completely addicted to the excesses of their jobs and the frequent massive adrenaline spikes. He'd turned them into junkies. Their habit kept them loyal to him, because nowhere else could they find anything remotely close to the life of working with Coronet. Vincent Chen himself was an addict, and he knew it. He had enough money in various offshore accounts that he could have easily retired and lived the 70 years in modest comfort without ever working another day. But, like the members of his team, modest was not something he ever wanted to experience again. After hours of movement and a generous cooling-off period from the time of the PNP officer's death, Amanda, one of the female members of his team, made contact via mobile phone and reported that neither she nor any of the others had seen anything remotely resembling a tail. The Abu Sayyaf counter-surveillance team, such as it was, reported the same. Both Dazid and Chen deemed the situation as safe as possible, though it was never completely so, and met at a small beachside cafe in Panabo, northeast of Davao City, for a breakfast of coffee, dried milkfish, and pandesal, the small bread rolls Chen found to be one of the best things about the Philippines. Dazid was remarkably forthcoming for a wanted man.
This operation you suggest, the Abu Sayyaf commander said, chewing an unsightly mouthful of bread and salted fish. It will require zealots. This is true, Chen said. He dabbed his mouth with a napkin in an effort to get the other man to do the same. It didn't work, and he gave up. I did not suppose that would be a problem. Dazeed grinned, showing a severe lack of dental care. My men possess plenty of zeal, but they would prefer to escape any action with their lives intact. I see, Chen said. Perhaps I have wasted your time then. Not at all, Dazeed said. There is no shortage of religious martyrs in Malaysia, so long as their families are well compensated. And you would see to it that they receive the compensation. Dazeed grinned again, nearly losing a mouthful of fish. He ate and spoke with gusto. Such would be my great honor. Chen considered the man for a long moment. He knew the man's honor was tied to the large sum of cash coming his way. More mercenary than religious extremist, Dazeed Ismail was, however, exactly what Chen needed. A zealot might veer off and attack a more attractive target for his cause. A mercenary would complete the task he'd been paid for, so as to make himself employable in the future. Finally, Chen said, "Excellent. Then we may move forward." By all means, Dazeed said, you are paying me well. I will provide the weapons, transport, and the men. He paused, sitting back as if to chew his cud while staring at the sea. Chen let him think, prodding only after he'd washed down a last bite of pandesal with the dregs of his coffee. There is something else, my friend. Dazeed snapped out of his trance and turned to look directly at Chen. As I told you, the martyrs will be no problem. They are intelligent enough, and they are no doubt willing to die. I must admit, though, that I have serious doubts about their ability to get close enough to an American warship to do any damage. Chen gave the man a soft smile, a smile that said he was absolutely sure of himself and of his plan. My group will be in close communication, he said. If your men do what my people say, exactly when they say it, I assure you that will not be an issue. The American Navy will come to them. Chapter 20
I'm not even supposed to be here, Eddie Fung stammered, his back against the cinder block wall of Dallas County's Loose Derrick Jail.
Individual cells ran around the edge of the open day room and down the corridors that radiated out like the spokes of a wheel. Time for lights out was fast approaching, but for now the prisoners in this pod sat in small knots of congruent color and race around the open bay. Some watched a small television in a cage on a wall. Some played cards. Some, Fung imagined, plotted to kill him. There was a control room at the far end, staffed by two DSOs who faced in opposite directions, dividing their time between a set of far too many monitors and the day room of a different pod. Fung doubted they would see a triple homicide if it went down right in front of them. The place smelled like farts and Lysol, but it didn't matter. He was so scared he could hardly breathe anyway. The African-American Detention Services officer standing beside him was nice enough. She was about the same size as Fung, with hair buzzed as short as humanly possible, but that could still be called hair, and an oval face that said she would have been attractive out of the formless green uniform. The tag on her chest identified her as Officer Lincoln. Fung thought she'd smiled at him once while he was standing on the red line at the booking counter, but the more he talked to her now, the more he thought maybe she just had indigestion. "I'm not kidding," Fung yammered on. "I really should be in solitary. I'm helping out the FBI on some high-level stuff." The DSO rolled her eyes, then scanned the crowded day room full of inmates. She kept her voice low, just loud enough for him to hear. "Why don't you speak up a little bit? I'm sure there are a lot of nice citizens in here who never met a real live rat before." Fung gulped, pulling his arms, turtle-like, inside the top of his orange jail scrubs,
in an effort to chase away the chill. For some reason, they kept this place like a damned refrigerator.
Right,
he said. I've just never been in jail before. He shrugged, armless, and inched closer to Officer Lincoln like a frightened child looking to make friends with the teacher at recess. Lincoln gave him a glare. Her voice boomed. Back off, inmate. A husky DSO with a blonde porn star mustache glanced up. Lincoln shook her head and raised a hand to let him know she had the situation under control. He went back to watching the inmates as they lined up at the payphones. Fung took a step back, grimacing at her sudden outburst. She gave a slow nod. You're welcome, she said.
What?
She continued to look out at the day room. I just gave you some undeserved street cred in here, inmate. These animals think you popped off to me, and they'll give you a little space for a minute. People in here smell fear. Know what I'm saying?
Got it, Fung said. Thank you.
Would you mind making a call to the FBI for me? Tell them something's messed up?
Officer Lincoln turned now and gave him a disgusted stare. Seriously, inmate. You really need to back off. Across the day room, DSO Tony Chang stepped out of the control room and made his way across the open floor. A couple other correctional officers rolled their eyes, but the inmates moved out of his way. He spent a lot of time in the gym and was proud that his girlfriend had taken up the sides of his size 17 uniform shirt so it formed a tight V from his lats down to his 32-inch waist. The inmates needed to see they weren't the only ones who could do pull-ups. Reaching the 2 East corridor, Chang gave a quiet nod to an Asian inmate lined up at the bank of payphones. The young man at the phones, who had a Sun Yi On triangle tattooed on his neck, was a recent initiate, and Chang knew he was eager to prove his devotion to the Brotherhood. Chang had been the one to handle Eddie Fung's booking. A simple tick in the wrong computer box saw to it that he didn't end up in solitary like the FBI requested. Chang tried to get the guy thrown in with the Triad brothers who'd been arrested at Chicas, but they'd all been put on lockdown, so it was all up to him. On cue, the tattooed man spun in line and punched the nearest inmate in the throat. This man, who happened to be a short but extremely muscular member of La M.A., staggered backward just long enough to catch his breath. The Mexican Mafia soldier recovered quickly and rushed the lighter Asian who had dared to disrespect him, driving him into the concrete wall. 4 other Triad members, unaware of any arrangement with Officer Chang, jumped to the defense of their embattled brother, piling on in a flurry of fists and elbows and teeth. Their presence drew more La M.A. foot soldiers into the fight. Ethnic and rival gang tensions boiled just below the surface of these men, incarcerated nose to nose with people who they'd just as soon see dead on the street. In prison, gang members might be segregated. County jails did what they could, but space was at more of a premium. Alarms began to sound, echoing off the concrete and steel enclosure. Inmates not involved in the fight reluctantly stepped away from the free entertainment as the bored-sounding intercom announcement that accompanied the alarms ordered them to their cells. Seconds later, heavy boots slapped the tile floor as detention officers poured into the day room from various points around the jail. Officer Chang stayed where he was, glancing up at the control room. The 2 officers inside stood up so they could see over their screens. Inmates filed by, returning to their assigned cells. When Eddie Fung shuffled past, arms tucked inside the sleeves of his scrubs, Officer Chang fell in behind and followed him to his cell. Hold up, Chang said, pulling Fung aside to give the other inmates time to move to their own cells and get out of earshot. Aren't you supposed to be in solitary? Fung's mouth fell open.
Finally, he said. Somebody's got their shit together. Thank you. Seriously, man, thank you.
Klaxons still raged, not quite drowning out the free-for-all that had broken out in the day room. Come on, Chang said, motioning down the now empty corridor toward the heavy steel door. Roll up your stuff. I was just coming to look for you. Fung's 2 cellmates would be involved in the fight, so it would just be Chang and the inmate. The inmate was so happy about moving to solitary, he was humming when he walked into the cell, and didn't see Chang place the small rubber wedge that would keep the door from closing all the way. All Fung's personal belongings had been taken, either by the FBI or at booking. He'd been issued a wool blanket and a stubby pink toothbrush made of flexible rubber. It wasn't much, but when nothing is all you have, even a toothbrush that looks like a kid's toy is a treasure worth guarding. Chang took the small syringe from his shirt pocket and stepped forward, jamming the needle into the back of Fung's thigh. At the same moment, the singing idiot decided to turn around and thank him again. Fung jerked away, swiping at Chang with one hand and throwing the pitiful toothbrush with the other. The syringe went flying and landed in the stainless steel sink-toilet combination. Unfortunately, Chang had been in mid-push, and the contents of the syringe that hadn't gone into Fung's leg ended up on the floor. Chang grabbed Fung by the throat and drove him backward into the lower bunk, fingers squeezing tight to keep him from crying out. With the syringe gone, he had no way of knowing how much fentanyl had made it into Fung's muscle. 3 milligrams would be enough to kill a normal-sized man, and Fung was a runt. Even so, Chang had intended to give him half again that much, just to be on the safe side. The DSO was making a decent side living selling fentanyl in the jail. The markup was incredible, with a $500 investment bringing him as much as 10 grand. He could have made more out on the street. These inmates weren't exactly rolling in cash, and he sure as shit wasn't going to take cup of noodles or honey buns in trade. Still, 10 grand was 10 grand. The fentanyl came in from China, where it was manufactured in legal labs, and then stashed in the little desiccant packs of silica in pairs of running shoes he ordered online. It was almost too easy, and he got to keep the running shoes. Everybody knew the fentanyl was coming inside. The inmates called it Murder 8. When it didn't kill them, it made them lethargic and easy to deal with, unlike the spice and other toxic shit that was being smuggled in. Chang sometimes felt that he was providing a service of calm for his fellow DSOs. Fung had been so flighty at booking that no one would question it if he died of an overdose. Chang had the stuff on hand already. A call from a contact said the Sun Yi On brothers needed a favor, and there would be an extra 20 G's in it for him. It would have been so easy if the dumb bastard hadn't turned around. Chang held him against the bed with his body weight, one hand on his neck, the other flat across his mouth. Finally, he felt the man go limp. Seconds later, he gave a series of gurgling croaks. If Chang had injected enough, Fung should have stopped breathing. But he didn't. His pupils constricted to tiny black dots. His lips turned blue and his breathing was labored, but his stupid lungs still pumped away. The syringe lay on the ground at Chang's feet in a puddle of liquid. He thought about picking it up and trying to inject any remaining drops, but the syringe was wet. He felt in his pocket for nitrile gloves and came up with only one. That wasn't going to work. Fentanyl was potent stuff and could be absorbed through the skin. Chang let the man drop face first onto the lower bunk, stifling the urge to bash his head against the wall or simply choke the life out of him. Either would leave far too much physical evidence. But if it came to that, he'd do what he had to do and work out the rest later. He couldn't leave Fung like this. If the drug wore off without killing him, Chang would end up in jail himself. And correctional officers didn't do well on the inside. Alarms still sounded up and down the corridor, but the riot would be quelled at any moment. Whatever Chang did, he had to do it quickly. An army of detention officers would have descended on the day room by now. His Sun Yi On brothers had done what they could, but they could keep the diversion going for only so long. Chang pulled the feed to the camera in this cell just before the fight broke out, leaving the control room no time to notice the gray screen among the dozens they already had to watch. He scanned the tiny space, racking his brain for some sort of plan. Then he looked down at Fung and realized the answer was right there in front of him. Jail administrators went to great lengths to keep inmates from harming themselves, but if someone was determined to die, they found a way. Chang had seen some ingenious methods over his 4 years as a correctional officer. One guy had even stuffed enough toilet paper down his own throat that it was impossible to get out. It was interesting to watch, but Chang didn't have time for that now. This needed to be much quicker. Fortunately, prisoners had developed several methods to bring about their own deaths that were relatively quick, and at least as important.